You are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. Makaiwatch is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with Tahiti Nui, Heaven on Earth, The Greenery Cafe.
Announcing the return of the Tahiti Nui's Hanalei Luau, featuring 50 years of songs and dances as a tribute to their mama, Auntie Louise. Tahiti Nui, providing live Hawaiian music on Kauai since 1963. This family-style luau is every Wednesday, 5 to 7:30. More information at 826-6277 or online at thenui.com.
Heaven on Earth starts here. Organically grown, GMO-free vegetable starts available at Hoku Foods in Kapa'a, Kauai Seascapes Nursery in Kalihiwai Ridge, and Saturday Morning Market next to Kauai Mini Golf. More information at heavenonearthstarts@gmail.com.
The Greenery Cafe in the heart of Lihue, one block off of Rye Street on Akahi Street, serving flavorful and organic soul food, wraps, smoothies, herbal iced teas, desserts, and vegetarian meals. Located in the lush garden setting near Tip Top Cafe, call-in, takeout, and catering available. Open Monday through Friday for breakfast and lunch. The Greenery Cafe, hearty, healthy soul, 246-4567, or online at thegreenerycafe.com.
Aloha, Kauai. This is Rachel from Kauai Invasive Species Committee. Invasive species can threaten native ecosystems, biodiversity, agriculture, and our quality of life. We are asking you to help be Kauai's eyes and ears for invasive species. Some we can hear, like the koki frog, and some we can feel, like the tree-dwelling little fire ant that can fall on us and leave powerful stings for up to 2 weeks. Invasive species are everyone's kuleana. If you see or hear the koki frog or little fire ant, please give us a call at 821-1490 or email me at kisk@hawaii.edu. That's kisk@hawaii.edu.
Hawaii waters are warming. Our corals are bleaching. You can be a part of the solution. Get trained to help. Come to the Eyes of the Reef training Thursday, October 1, 6 p.m. Koloa Library. Mahalo to our partners, Tahiti Nui, Heaven on Earth, The Greenery Cafe.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Oh, we ain't got a barrel of money. Maybe we're ragged and funny, but we'll travel alone, singing a song side by side.
Aloha and welcome to Makaiwatch, a program about fa'aina, those things that feed us. We provide information and opportunities for community involvement in the stewardship of our resources on Kauai. Makai, toward the ocean, as all things flow to the sea, and the sea is connected to you and me. The Hanalei Makai Watch program publishes the Hanalei Moon and Tide Calendar, now in its fourth printing. Please call the office, 826-1985, to receive yours today. My name is Maka'ala, and I'd like to thank KKCR for providing this program, and Laura Christine for engineering it for us today. Please remember this program and all of the others on the station are funded by you, our listeners here on Kauai, in Hawaii, or across the ocean on a land far, far away. Please show your support and join our membership today. We will be happy to take your calls after we've introduced our subject for today. The number here is 826-7771. Today our guest is, and I'm going to say this, it sounds really uncomfortable for me because he's a friend of mine, Dr. Lance Collins. Lance is a friend and a hardworking friend of the culture and environment in Hawaii. Welcome, Lance.
Aloha.
Thank you for traveling to Kauai today. I think you came from Honolulu today.
I did.
And we're grateful that you came over. It's a little clearer when we don't have you call in, so thank you for making that effort. To begin today, I'd just like to have you talk a little bit about yourself, who you are, where you came from, and at least a few of the many things that you're involved with.
Okay. As you said, my name is Lance Collins. I'm from the island of Maui, and I practice law on the island of Maui still. I'm officially a doctor. I also have a PhD in political science, and a master's degree in indigenous politics, both from the University of Hawaii. Some of the things that are sort of in the forefront right now of items I'm working on are I represent a group of folks on Maui who are trying to get the sugar plantation there to change their harvesting practices and possibly also the kinds of crops that they grow. That's a big issue on Maui, 37,000 acres of land still planted in sugar. And most of it is burned. And so these groups are asking the sugar plantation to change its practices. I have a number of cases on appeal right now before the Intermediate Court of Appeals. One of them is a case you're involved with against the Office of Elections in how they are conducting certain aspects of the election and voting process without going through proper rulemaking procedures. Big concern statewide. So those are just some of the different kinds of things that I'm currently just filed a lawsuit. Very sad thing, and I know this has also happened on Kauai, is that certain land developers manipulate the affordable housing crisis and the affordable housing statutes to, in a very cynical way, try to disregard all environmental review processes. And so just filed a lawsuit for the Ma'alaya Community Association and Maui Tomorrow Foundation about a development that previously they had sued when the developer did not do a correct environmental impact statement, and developer is now, this time, was able to get a FONSI over practically the same project. So that's going to court, and hopefully the developer will change his mind, or the family will, that the developer will change their mind and do the correct environmental review process. So
it's interesting. It's almost a double whammy, a double wrong, double bad. You didn't do the right thing the first time, and now you're doing something else. We are seeing that on this island with some of the affordable housing issues. And, you know, if I'm going to do this good and noble thing, then I should not have to do all the things that everybody else has to do, especially environmentally. We actually just had that happen, in my view, here in Hanalei, in Princeville, where we had the Kolopua affordable housing units go in. I need to point those out to you when I drive you back the other way. They look like chicken coops to me, but they used asphalt, and it seemed to me that the people that we build affordable housing for, those of us who are needy of those services, deserve the very best we can do, not the least we can do. And that's become kind of a mantra for me. And I guess I should make bumper stickers. I think that's kind of what you're talking about. You know, you're going to do something noble. You still have to do all the other good stuff, too. You can't just, you know, skip over. And it's hard, because we really need the affordable housing. So it's a great deal of community, public, political pressure to do this thing to help our people get off the streets and
Absolutely.
Off the beaches. We get it. But it doesn't mean you have to, you know, foul up the neighborhood in order to do that. Or
right. And, you know, another concern with that this isn't really related to that lawsuit, but something that I've seen on Maui, and I've actually represented somebody trying to get action, is in a lot of these affordable projects, the people who buy have to sign an affidavit saying that they will for 1 year live in the house. And what has turned out is that happens a lot to not happen. People will sign it, and then the banks who sell these units to investors and the developers who sell it to investors tell them, oh, well, you just have to have the intention to live there for a year, but if you change your mind after you sign this affidavit under oath, you won't be held to it or anything. And, you know, the real estate commission doesn't investigate. They've never investigated. So I represented someone on Maui who was complaining about the neighbor who, I guess, was, you know, late at night constantly making loud noise, and the association wouldn't do anything. And then she found out, hey, this isn't the affordable house. You know, the guy who lives here is a tenant, and there's not supposed to be any tenants in this development for a year. Went to the real estate commission and RICO. In fact, the real estate commission didn't even realize it had the authority to do anything, and they kicked it out saying, oh, we don't investigate those things. Well, I cited the chapter in the section. Here, it's right here. Oh! And they're still investigating it 2 years later. They're still investigating what they're supposed to do.
So if you haven't heard of Lance Collins before, this is exactly what he does. He has the I don't know where he gets it. I don't think he sleeps. But the tenacity to do the paperwork. He'll do the detailed work. It's a good thing you went into law because that's what lawyers are supposed to do. But we all know a lot of lawyers that don't get down into the mud like you do. But he does. He says, no, and I'm going to read it. And this is what it says, and this is what you have to do. And anybody in this world that actually does the reading and does the looking is going to froth to the top because so many people are what, you know, it was Jim Anthony that used to say, people are just intellectually lazy. And if you're not intellectually lazy, you can get a lot done in this world if you actually look at the rules and look at the laws. We have a lot of good rules and laws. We need to use them. So that went off on a tangent, and this whole conversation is going to go that way, folks. So just, you know, seatbelt up, strap in. I asked Lance to come on the show today because I joined a workshop that he coordinated in Maui recently. And I'm not sure I called it the right thing in my notes. I called it the Hawaii Environmental Law Workshop. Was that even close?
It was Environmental and Hawaiian Law Workshop. Close,
well,
yeah.
Close for all government purposes. And it was a fascinating group of people. You really collected quite an eclectic group of folks who came at Hawaii law and environmental law from knowledgeable perspectives, people that had been involved, been engaged, people that knew something, and lots of community people, and you gathered people from all over. And tell me a little bit about how that happened. Where did the idea to do that workshop come from?
Well, it actually originated several years ago, and it originally was going to be former councilwoman Michelle Anderson giving a full-day workshop on Chapter 343, which is the environmental review process. And for a number of reasons, it fell through, and then we were going to have one person come once a month for a year and give like an evening talk on some specialty, and John Van Dyke, who's a professor of law at UH, was going to be the first speaker, and it took several months to get everything together. I went down to the Parks Department to pay the deposit for the Lahaina Civic Center, and the woman that I was working with wasn't there that day, and the other woman wouldn't help me. She goes, why don't you just come back when whoever it was is there? And I said, oh, but I'm going on a trip for like a week, so if I don't do it today, you know, I want to make sure that it's reserved. And she goes, well, I can't help you. And John Van Dyke died the next day. So when that happened, everything got sort of stopped. Then in June, I was at a environmental law workshop with Maka'ala and Hilo that ended the day that the protests up on the mountain happened.
Which was very serendipitous, folks, by the way. If you ever run into me in the community and you ask me if I've ever been up to the mountain, yes, I have, because I was taken. because they don't let old ladies like me drive out of our little villages, and so when I'm brought somewhere, I have a handler or two sometimes, and in this case I had a young attorney, Shay Kamaka'ala, and she was driving, and she said, Auntie, we're going. And I said, cool, I'm ready. I don't know, do we have jackets? It's going to be freezing. And it was amazing, and I'm so glad I went that day. That was the day, and we walked as far as we felt we wouldn't be part of the process because we weren't from there and we weren't part of their group. But for that workshop to have occurred, and then the very next day for all of us to be on Mauna Kea was quite extraordinary and very educational.
Yeah, well, I unfortunately didn't end up going up to Mauna Kea, but at the end of the workshop, I talked with the other Maui people, and I said, you know, we've been trying to get these things, these educational things on Maui to happen, and things keep falling through. I am committed, even if I have to steal the money, I am committed to getting this to happen before the end of the year, because I can just see that if we don't keep this momentum going, that this educational thing and cross fertilization between different aspects of environmental and Hawaiian law, that these connections need to be reaffirmed and reinforced. And so I immediately got to work with Bianca Isaki, and we were able to pull it off.
Get some
barely.
Funding. Yeah, get some funding and get us there. And one of the things I want to make this point fairly early in this conversation, and that is that even though that workshop was on Maui, the cross-fertilization really is active there. I mean, the opportunity to talk to each other always results in, oh, really? You're doing that too? Oh, really? You have that same problem? Oh, really? And maybe learning a little bit from each other about our paths and successes and failures. But many of the issues, you and I were talking in the car on the way here today about our current county council on Kauai is discussing the potential for county manager as opposed to the current system with the mayor and the council. And or in conjunction with, I think, is the way we should say that. And also the issue of, do we want districting for our elected county council officials? Maui's doing the same thing. And it's interesting. I wish somebody would do it ahead of us so that we could just, they could part the seas and make our path a little easier. But that doesn't happen. We all seem to be doing this at the same moment in time. But you've been involved in some of those issues here as well.
Yeah, well, the district voting thing on Maui has sort of come to a standstill. But there was significant, major opposition from the powers that be on Maui to having that go through. I mean, there were scientific polls were taken, and it's clear that a super majority of people on Maui want it. But unfortunately,
politicians are not so sure.
Well, yeah, one of the things about district voting is that, it's, for example, between a Senate race and a House race, it's easier to run in a House race and can generally be more competitive than a Senate race just because you only have to reach half as many people. And especially on Maui, where there's a number of areas that are rural, and, you can't just walk door to door. I mean, you can maybe if there's like a subdivision or something, but, like in Hana, you can do the subdivision in Hana Town, but that's about it in terms of walking door to door. Otherwise, you have to drive like half a mile up someone's driveway to get, and people don't want you there. So it becomes very difficult to have to run a countywide campaign for a council seat. And I think the powers that be, the main issue that they have is that they lose a significant amount of control over the types of voices that would end up being on the council if there were nine, individual council races as opposed to nine countywide races.
And I don't think we're that different, because if you look at the population centers here, the east side in Kapaha, that part of the Wailua area, and then Lihue area. So, there's something to be said for thinking about the equity of the lower populated areas and the more rural areas, such as the North Shore or the west side even, of this island. So the issue is not different. It's a different island, but kind of the same deal. One of the reasons that I tried really hard to get you here is because although you said yes quickly, I shouldn't say that I tried really hard, but I thought about it immediately after that workshop, because I've long held a concern about the management of our oceans and our nearshore marine resources. As you are well aware, Haena has now an approved community-based subsistence fishing area, and the state is working on the actual management plan for that process. And I've been aware of some entities and large organizations from elsewhere feeling as though or acting as though these local initiatives are opportunities for them, both for good and ill, to come in and help communities do things that maybe communities haven't been able to do in a while, certainly in the management plan scheme as it might fit with government, because that's not the tradition and the history here. But also to feather their own nests. These can be money making opportunities for some of these organizations. And I've come to the point, personally at least, that I'm just going to start saying this stuff out loud. And you used a word when we talked and emailed back and forth after the workshop of colonist and colonization. And that really piqued my interest because it seemed to me to be a really good fit for exactly what this is. In all senses of the word colonist. Colonist in the sense that, you know, a place needs that kind of help or whatever, but also colonist in the sense of someone from elsewhere coming in and profiting from a place. Can you talk a little bit about that? And specifically, I'm just going to name it. Organizations. We have two in the state that are very active. One is the Nature Conservancy, which I think has been a better actor in recent years. They've really been able to work with community and be guided by community, and I think have done a much better job. And certainly their Malka work is extraordinary. But now comes Conservation International, who seems to be talking to communities who are trying to get their act together and trying to manage their own resources. And I'm uncomfortable. I'm not sure why I'm uncomfortable, but I'm uncomfortable.
Well, yeah, so for, you know, for the colonial issue, you know, there's always a concern that, you know, what exactly is going on here with our local resources and that sort of thing. And, you know, in the 19th century, there were two different kinds of environmental concerns. They were articulated in conservation, and they were articulated as preservation. Those were the two ways that, and conservation always had the belief that, well, nature has been degraded, and so we need to conserve the resources and make them better or protect them and that sort of thing. And preservation was the idea that some area is pristine and it needs to be preserved before it's touched by man. That was the sort of thing. And the problem with both of those viewpoints was that, first of all, they were coming from the sort of imperial center imperial centers of Europe and the East Coast of the United States. And in the conservation model, the idea was that, oh, well, the natives have destroyed, you know, the resources, so it's the white man's burden to come in and, like, stop that from, you know, stop that and, you know, make sure that, you know, nature is conserved. And then the other idea was that, well, there's no natives here, we're just gonna put some boundaries. And if there are a few natives, well, that's not really part of nature, so they'll get pushed out. And so, you know, the national park system, which is, you know, I think on all accounts is a good system, started in that area. I mean, national parks were created by the same people who felt that Indians should be put on reservations. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, there's sort of this land grab. And so one of the big concerns with conservation and preservation is there's this, the historical roots of different types of colonialism. So it's like, okay, well, it's good that the colonial bureaucracy should conserve natural resources, but why was the environment degraded in the first place? Oh, that's because for the last 200 years, you've been stripping all of the natural resources and using the natives as slaves to do it. And so now that everybody's alienated from their land and you've totally disrupted their cultural practices, oh, now they need even more help from you, right? It's just this sort of thing where it's like, well, the outsider's done all of this damage, so, you know, why don't you come and save us? I think that that's one of those issues. And I guess where Conservation International plays into that, one example is their debt for nature swaps. Maybe people aren't very familiar with this, but certain large transnational NGOs like Conservation International have gotten the money to buy out the foreign debt that a country has, some amount of foreign debt, then uses it. So the traditional model in international finance and sovereign finance was that one of the ways to, you know, free some of the developing countries from their international debt would to spur investment from the developed countries where investors would go in, buy the nation's debt or some portion of it, convert it into local currency, and then use it to invest in local development projects. And, you know, that was sort of the debt swapping there, was to essentially use the liberal free trade model to get, essentially taking a country's foreign debt and converting it into local, you know, investment stuff. The problem is that, you know, it's like where you build a Ford, you know, motor company when manufacturing plant when nobody in the country needs it, it doesn't necessarily help anything and can harm things. And so that has its critics. And so the certain conservation groups like Conservation International turn that model into, well, we'll use that to essentially get the country to buy a preservation area with its own debt. Like, okay, we'll get rid of your debt, but you have to agree that the value of this land equals that, and so we'll forgive your debt, but you have to do this and you have to make this legislation to protect it in a certain way. So the example with Conservation International is they did that in Bolivia with the Beni Nature Preserve, or I don't know the full name of it, but it's the Beni area. And everyone was saying, oh, this is the greatest thing. And the Bolivian government was a little bit concerned, but they thought, well, you know, it's better than racking up the interest rate and sounds like a fair deal. The problem was that the indigenous people who lived in that area were fighting the national government at that time to establish that that was their lands. And the only way in the Bolivian legal system that that could be done was by getting essentially the tribe getting title to that land. Well, when this went through, they couldn't do that anymore because now Conservation International had done this debt for nature swap. And so that whole area could no longer be titled to anybody because it was part of this nature preserve that had to follow all of these requirements that was done through national legislation. And so what ended up happening was Conservation International came in and preserved this area, but at the same time ended up dispossessing the native people of that area. And so that's, you know, that's an example of one of these things. And there's also concerns just for the national governments in general. It's like, well, how is this not just another form of neocolonialism?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you know, it's some foreign entity that's coming in and essentially using the country's debt as another way to make them do something.
The Mighty Mouse syndrome. It's, you know, here I am to save the day. As if the peoples of that place didn't have the information that they needed to preserve, to conserve, that there's not a lot of other issues and powers in play that have stunted that, but that they don't have that knowledge. So your work with indigenous stuff, one thing we know about the peoples of a place is that they're very, very smart about their place. They might be ostracized from the system, or they might not know how to play the game. But when it comes to making rules, for example, here in Haena in the fisheries, they know exactly what needs to be done. They know which fish to rest. They know how long they need to rest them. They know how to move, you know, the resting areas around. They know what they're concerned about because they still have the information of what used to be there. It's the same with your example in Bolivia. Here, these people really did know what to do to conserve and preserve that place, but they were disconnected from the way to do it, just given land tenure and things like that. And my concern is that, you know, it takes many people. I get that it takes partnerships. I get that no, you know, one people from one place can probably pull this off anymore. There's just too much complexity in how we write our laws and our environmental laws and policies and so forth. But to make sure that the people of place have an opportunity to identify who's really there to help and who's there to profit. And if they're there to help and will profit, that might be fine. That might be hunky-dory, but everybody should know it. You know, that fact should be on the table.
Yeah, and I think one of the concerns with national organizations and international organizations, and I was mentioning this before the show, you know, in the LGBT communities, in the 70s and the 80s, same-sex marriage was sort of considered a fringe idea of, you know, people who wanted, like, establishment people. You know, it was like this fringe view of, well, they just want to make us like everybody else. And there were all these other things that were going on, which were fairly radical. And then there was sort of the middle road, which was enacting anti-discrimination laws. That was the big thing in the 70s and the early 80s. But then what happened was that there was a push to consolidate media in the LGBT community. So where the bars used to pay the local publisher to have a, you know, magazine, these, they sort of started getting elbowed out by national media, so that suddenly by the early 90s, there were all of these national, you know, magazines and stuff. And so all of the local voices started disappearing, and these national organizations appeared, NGOs appeared at the same time, and they were getting their money from these, you know, these slick national magazines. There was like this whole loop, funding loop of this sort of nationalizing of LGBT community. And they decided that the most respectable thing to do is get same-sex marriage, and that's the issue. And so that ended up pushing all of the other possible priorities of local communities off to the side, and all money was going towards same-sex marriage. And of course, we now know that same-sex marriage is legal. And the irony of that is that LGBT communities in many parts of the country, other than on the West Coast and in the Northeast, are now suffering from discrimination and employment and housing because there's no laws protecting them. And okay, they can get married, and so what?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So it's that sort of, you know, and that's one of the dangers of, you know, when the decisions about what movements and communities do end up getting centralized up to the national and international level, is that sometimes the thing that's actually the most important on a practical level to most people gets pushed aside for these sort of theoretical, you know, ideological issues that may not really have anything to do with most people's day-to-day stuff.
But that are easier to do.
Easier to understand by people who have lots of money.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's much easier for, you know, Ford or IBM or Apple or, the, you know, these big companies to say, you know, yes, we support same-sex marriage and, you know, we support LGBT because we fund all of this money for same-sex marriage or whatever, and then there's no money for employment, you know, anti-discrimination laws or housing or that kind of stuff. And that's, that becomes a problem, is that, well, the people with all the money end up going to these international or national, and they set all of the agenda and policy, and then they leave the grassroots people, you know, out. And I mean, it's, I use LGBT because it's easy for people to understand that, but yeah, that happens in every kind and every type of movement.
Well, it's happening a lot here at home, and so I want to take a break, and I want you, please, because I asked you to bring the music and you did, just talk a little bit about who this is, who this lady is.
Oh, okay. So I it's called Down With Empire, and it's from the album Save the World, and the band is Keiko Bonk and Kazan. And Keiko Bonk was the first Green Party person elected to a partisan office in the United States. She was elected to the Council of the Big Island, and she became the chairwoman of the Big Island County Council. And so this is from her. This is, she did this after she was on the council, but she actually did have a band in the East Village in the 80s. So.
Welcome back. You're listening to KKCR Hanalei KAQA Kilauea. This is the Makai Watch program. My name is Maka Allen. With me today is Lance Collins, and we're talking about, oh my goodness, let's see if I can figure out what it is we're talking about. we're talking about the politics of community and how community sometimes is the player and sometimes is the played. And the non-governmental organization, NGOs, who are trying often to do the right thing and the good thing, and sometimes get brought in and swept up in this thing that Lance calls the loop, which I think is really a good word for it, because money goes round and round and round. Maybe someday we'll have to get that song for one of our break songs, but when you think you know who you're dealing with, you probably don't. When you think you know who's behind something, you probably don't. And mahalo to all those people in our community and in our society who do that work, who investigate where the money actually does come from. And, you know, some of it gets spent for good things in spite of them.
Yeah.
For us in this part of the world, we're sitting in a very unique position because of climate change, sea level rise, marine issues and matters, fisheries, needs for proteins, some of the current efforts to save what we have and enhance what we have and bring it back to what we used to have. There's a lot of players in the pool, and I try to make an effort when I know it, and I don't often know all the players, that's for sure. But when I do know the players and what their possible other motives or other agendas or other reasons are, I try to say so out loud, just because not in a way of calling somebody out, but just to say, okay, but this is the fact, you know, this is where we are. In this situation, It might be interesting for folks to know that Conservation International is funded heavily by the Moore Foundation. The Moore Foundation is the major funder of the TMT telescope in Mauna Kea. So, you know, not to say that funders can't fund good things and fund bad things, but I think that's important information for folks to have. Laura was reminding Lance and me just a minute ago, too, about the concept of, even on Kauai, where we have concerns about pesticides, and we had concerns about GMO, and there were some people who were really concerned about the pesticides, and that seemed to be the issue. And then we knew we needed help, and some of the organizers brought in people, and they kind of changed the conversation, which is what you were just talking about with the LGBT community, where their issue was discrimination and fair housing and fair employment, but same-sex marriage was, if I can use the word, sexier, easier, I'm not sure. And so as they asked for help in organizing and funding and putting that all together, the conversation changed, the subject changed. And I think we've seen a little bit of that here on Kauai with some of our seed companies and some of our issues in the west side. Are we more concerned about GMOs? Are we more concerned about pesticides? And surely there's people that are concerned about both. But I think when we began the conversation, it was about the chemicals. It was about the dust. And yes, it has evolved and expanded. But are we the ones I don't know. Are we the ones driving that conversation? My interest and involvement has been strictly related to those things that are Makai. I mean, my concerns have been about, you know, how is this impacting the marine resources? And that certainly hasn't been as much about GMO as it has been about the pesticides and the dust. You know, how were these companies profiting from activities that were impacting those things that feed our people, those places that we want to have in good shape as sea level rise and warming waters is impacting them also. So the concept of one of the things you said you studied was indigenous politics. Good heavens, I didn't even know there was such a thing as indigenous politics. But since there is a thing called indigenous politics, Tell me a little bit about what indigenous politics is, because is that me, or is that the people that have never been touched or seen in the middle of some jungle somewhere? I mean, is that
no? Indigenous politics is it. When I was getting my degree, I was actually part of the first group of people at the University of Hawaii that were in it, and the reason why it was being created was because for people who got Hawaiian studies degrees, if you wanted to go into graduate school, your choices generally were anthropology or, you know, linguistics. I mean, there really wasn't. I mean, you could go into political science, and Noinoi Silva, for example, did go. She got her PhD in political science. But there wasn't really there wasn't sort of a institutional presence of Hawaiian studies students. And so when the group of Hawaiian studies graduates that included Mamo Kim and Kalawai Amor were trying to graduate, at the same time, the political science department established this program. So it's a sort of a branch of political science, but it focuses on the issues of imperialism, colonialism, and native peoples. And that's it's a, you know, and it can be as narrow. So most of the Hawaiian studies folks focus specifically on Hawaii-related issues. My focus was a little bit broader. My focus had to do with Austronesian peoples, Austronesian language speaking peoples. So that includes all of the people of the Pacific, and how American colonialism interacted with all of these different people. But that's how indigenous politics. And they had Rigoberta Menchu come to the University of Hawaii.
Wow.
They had what's the guy from East Timor who got the Peace Prize? He came too.
Very cool.
Yeah, so they had a bunch of people, indigenous leaders from around the world, come over several years, and so that's what indigenous politics is really about, is the study of the politics of colonialism and anti-colonial struggles.
Very cool. Laura, do we have a call?
Yeah, we have a caller that has a question.
Caller, you're on the air?
Yes, thanks a lot. My question specifically is, what leverage does the Hawaiian community and other interested folk have in terms of getting the federal government to address the destruction of the reefs and other damage caused by the electromagnetic radiation caused by the Navy and U.S. Defense Department, especially on the North Shore, namely the fact that because of all the microwave activity between the different ships and installations on Kauke'i, that just what powered might indigenous Hawaiian communities and other interested folk have with the federal government in this specific regard?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, I think the short answer is not much, but actually your question raises an important point, and that is the ways actually that the federal government in very indirect ways tries to manipulate the conversation that Native peoples have with each other about these particular issues. And so one example that comes immediately to mind is Westpac, which is a federal agency established by the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And Westpac uses a lot of its resources to support certain viewpoints in the Native Hawaiian community that support ideologically the positions of the international fishing conglomerates that are destroying our oceans. And so that's one way where the federal government indirectly uses its power to skew and manipulate the conversation so that it in some ways it seems at certain times that important local environmental goals are in conflict with Native, you know, fisher folk, for example, when in fact they aren't at all. And so that's actually one of the ways where the federal government does get involved in a less than a proactive way. And the, but to answer your question directly is not much in the way of positive, positive transformation.
Except to the extent that, that communities follow what the Haena example is, which is at least 1 mile out and managing their own fisheries. And it is the first, and so it's going to take some time and a whole lot of effort to figure out how that's actually going to work. But at least it's people in the place. So my response is, and almost always is, you start where you are. So wherever that person is that cares, whatever their place is, you start where you are and you inform yourself as best you can about what's going on in your place and find ways to communicate whatever your concerns or issues are with other peoples of place. But the solution, in my view at least, is to work in partnerships, because nobody can do this work all by themselves.
No, it's impossible.
The good news is the government can't either. So the government partners that work with our community hear me say a lot, I really don't mind when the government is broke. I actually really like it when the government is broke, because when the government is broke, they need the non-governmental organizations, the NGOs, the nonprofits, the community organizations. They need us to partner because they still have to perform their mission. They still have to do what they say they're going to do by law. And when they're broke, they can't do it on their own. And I like that because I think partnerships is where it's at. When it comes to indigenous politics, the thing that fascinates me, I think, is how to get that kind of information out to community that they have, that there is such a thing as indigenous politics, that there's stuff that they already know. They don't have to go to school for that. There's things they already know that give them the foundation and the power, if you will, to do stuff.
Absolutely.
People don't value the information that they have. What they know, traditional knowledge and traditional practices, is expensive.
That's right.
If you're going to be somebody like the Nature Conservancy or CI and come in to a community and try to to duplicate what the people of that place already know. It would cost you a small fortune.
Yeah, well, and I think that's, you know, one of the things that Hannah Bernard, who's Maui Big Island environmentalist, brought up is that, you know, using what the scientists, as they call themselves and are called, have determined the sort of best management practices for an area and how, you know, certain loads of different species exist under those system is roughly equivalent to traditional knowledge of that area being implemented under the enforcement regime. The results are essentially the same in terms of being able to sustain, you know, the living ice box.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, and so that's the thing is that, you know, I can't remember the woman's name. She's from Molokai. She said, you know, we're all on the same mountain, but we're just at different points. So we're all seeing the same thing, but we see it in a slightly different way. And the important thing is to, you know, work together and be able to accomplish good. I mean, that's what she was saying about it. And so, you know, when it comes to, you know, traditional ways of knowing, you know, that I don't think that there's necessarily a conflict between traditional knowledge and Western scientific knowledge. You know, it really comes down to what is the, practically speaking, what is the goal and what are the values informing it? And I think most of the time, everybody's in agreement about all of those things. It's just sort of an interloper that shows up, and suddenly these two groups that are, you know, have a natural affinity for each other end up being on seemingly opposing sides. To what issue, it's not clear.
It's interesting, too. I remember it's been, I guess we've been doing this work for a couple of decades now, and we're still stumbling over the terminology, you know, and indigenous knowledge, traditional knowledge, citizen science, biocultural information. You know, we're still tripping over ourselves trying to label this stuff because it does run the gamut. So the MIT educated guy from elsewhere that comes to Haena to study fish is a what, and the guy who is born there and lives there and has managed that fishery all his life is a what? I mean, you know, these are labels and terminology that we've got to figure out at some point, because we're just right now, you know, waving and smiling at each other and saying, okay, we really are trying to do all the same things. And I remember when Alan Friedlander, who's one of the premier ichthyologists in the Pacific region, first started his work in Haena and Hanalei. He refused to wear any of those labels. He's, but you're a scientist, you know, you're big stuff. He says, the information that I'm gathering is no different than the information that the people of this place have. And I need what they know and they need what I know. And it comes down sometimes to simple mathematics, right? I mean,
right.
That's the difference, but it's the process for working together. My premise, however, and one of the things that I appreciate about the workshop that you organized and the work that you do is having the people of the place in the lead.
Absolutely.
That if they're not driving the bus, then the bus is going to go in the ditch. I mean, it's just going to happen. All those things you talked about at the beginning of the show, where these efforts have all, you know, dissolved or gotten off track. I think it's because the people of the place, you know, I often find myself, did we ask for that? Wait a minute. Whose idea was that? Because people want to come, you know, people want to come to Hanalei for a whole lot of reasons. One of them, of course, is surf. And then they declare there's an issue and they declare there's a problem. And they declare, you know, da 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 da. And I'm often scratching my head and go, wait a minute. You know, we've had, you know, 15 years of scientific study. We don't see that issue. I don't see that problem. So, or it's a different issue. So,
yeah.
Is there going to be a follow up kind of thing to that? I know we talked about a follow up for that workshop, and I realize it's not a public thing, but this is a conversation that is so timely.
Yeah, well, I think for that particular issue, I hope that there is a follow up in terms of, you know, a meeting. It's very hard to get a lot of people from all over the state to get to Maui. I mean, that was all of the funding for that workshop went to bringing folks from elsewhere to West Maui. But my understanding is that the Hilo meeting and the West Maui meeting has actually generated some bigger interest from a number of groups around the state that think that this idea of, you know, going around the islands to get people to come together and talk on a regular basis is beneficial. And so I'm optimistic that within the next year we will be seeing this, and hopefully this can be something that becomes a regular thing, which different groups sort of take the lead on.
This is the mission of Kua'aina Lu'awamo Kua, which took over for a community stewardship network, which took over for the community conservation network, which did what Uncle Mac Poi Poi and Molokai told us to do, which is, he said, gather us. Gather us, because the wisdom is there, the knowledge is there, and the discussion is there. And you took it to a different level. You took it to the law part, which was very, very important to be done. That's the piece that few of us have, and you have it, and people of your ilk, and that's the piece that community needs. That's the expertise. Lance, I can't thank you enough for taking the time and the trip and coming and joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was an honor to be here, and it's nice to know that there's still community media alive and well.
Yeah, the station in the jungle. And for turning us all on to Keiko Bonk. Yeah, Laura's turned on now, so she has her down. She's a very, very cool lady. We should have her come sometime and just talk about herself. Oh, boy, we would need a lawyer in the room for that. Thank you, everyone. We'll see you next month, first Monday. Aloha.
Aloha.